coming?
Great.
Okay. Excellent. Thank you.
Oh, you missed all day now?
Yeah, I know. We had our usual computer problem. Okay. We want right. Good. Okay. Announcements, briefly. Any announcements?
None.
Okay, seeing none, I want to talk about five levels of mindfulness, and then we'll sit. And different people will... interact with mindfulness at different levels. So it may be that what you're getting out of mindfulness is different than what somebody else is getting. And if you teach other people, they might get it at a different level than you currently understand it. So here are the five levels that I see. First level, calming down. Coming back to the breathing over and over again, no matter what else is happening. Not trying to change anything, just softening and opening. And that's the level that most of my students at City College get it at. They just say, it just helps me to be calmer when I need to be. And again, you do that not by trying to suppress anything or change anything. You just simply return attention to your breathing over and over and let yourself soften and open. Second level, the level of realization that your trouble is in your head. That is, it's not the world, it's your internalization of the world that is causing the difficulty. Even if you have a pain, it's your interpretation of the pain that's giving you most of your pain. So this realization is, whether you practice mindfulness or not, is really important. To realize that what you're saying to yourself is creating your reality. That's the basis, and if you change your narrative about yourself and your life, you'll change yourself and your life. This is the basis of cognitive therapy, cognitive psychology in general. So my students get that pretty well also, that, oh, I see, it's worrying about the test that's causing me stress right now. It's not that I'm actually under stress at this moment, it's that my thoughts are stressing me. Third level, have we got it? Thank you. Perfect. Okay. Third level of mindfulness. Reorienting yourself from past and future to present. So instead of being lost in thoughts of what happened or what will happen, instead, you pay attention to what's actually happening at present. You may still be thinking about it, but you know that you're here, you can see, you can smell, you're paying attention to your senses and to the present reality that you're in. And some of my students get that at City College. The fourth level of mindfulness, the level of developing the witnessing awareness. The level at which you realize that who you are is an awareness in which thoughts, feelings, and sensations happen. So you're more aware of what's around you because you're more aware of your senses. You're also more aware of what's your inner reality because you're more aware of your thoughts and your feelings. You're just not identified with what's around you or what's inside you. You're the central awareness rather than the weather of your experience. That's the level that most of us are practicing at. And then the fifth level is the level when you don't leave witnessing awareness very often, or if you do, you come back pretty regularly. That is, you live from witnessing awareness, so you're much less bound by your environment or your personality. And that's a level that many of us are slowly approximating. So that's nothing new for most of you, but I just thought that I would sketch that out briefly. Okay, Robin.
There must be higher levels, like that people call enlightenment, right?
Yeah, I don't know about it. I mean, I know about it theoretically, but not experientially. In other words, beyond that fifth level, the level of living from central awareness, the question is, what is that? How does that change you? How does it change your motivations? Are you motivated by the same egoic concerns, or are you motivated by some other level of yourself, or some other level, period, that may not be personal? And these are things that we can talk about, but these are not things that I feel qualified to lecture about. All right, so let's sit. Now, my usual cautionary note here. This is not a question of thinking differently or better. Okay. It is a question of returning attention to your breathing, as Chögyam Trungpa called the spiritual manual labor. Come back to your breathing over and over and over again. Keep softening and opening at every level. Just let yourself become more open, more soft, more open, more soft. Keep breathing. The witnessing awareness arises by itself. You don't think it into existence. You just start to notice words and pictures in your head, feelings in your body, sensations around you. Every time you get caught up and forget that you're just noticing, come back to breathing and noticing. That's all we're doing. Everything comes from that awareness. I'll ring the time, the bell in 10 minutes. So could you hear all those thoughts moving through your head? Who's listening? And where does the sense of me come in? Is me a property of the awareness, or is it a property of thinking about the awareness? Questions to contemplate. By the way, from John Kabat-Zinn's point of view, it doesn't matter how noisy your meditation experience was, what the thoughts going through your mind were, what the feelings you noticed were, what the sensations you noticed were. To him, it matters not at all. The only thing that matters is that you don't identify with those things. That you pull the identification back from whatever it is that you're experiencing. So that you gain a level of independence of those things. And a level of expansion that's beyond those things. Because those things, whatever you notice, you narrow onto. And if you have continuing thoughts in your head, you narrow onto that dialogue as your reality. You don't try to get rid of that dialogue. You just, as Michael Singer says, you fall behind it. You open behind it, I would say. And he was first, and then Chris.
It seems like beyond the fifth stage of conscious awareness and stabilizing witness, there is another level of consciousness that I'm attempting to describe in my own life and experience. It's an opening to now, where you can actually see an invisible wholeness at the next evolutionary stage, just the next moment. It's like when I breathe, when I bring now into being with my breath, and I am in that witnessing consciousness, I can see, sense, kind of a reality of indivisible wholeness moving me toward a next step, thought, and it's wholeness, and it's alive, and it's natural, organic wonder, which I'm calling now.
Yeah, I think that's well said. I talked about this, I think, last week. When one becomes less fascinated by this, then some of the awareness goes back to the process of being aware, and that leads in expansive and enlightening directions. That's all I want to say about it at this point. Okay. Chris, and then I want to move on.
I think, probably you have the answer already, the space that Viktor Frankl was talking about between action and the impulse. What was it?
The impulse of the action.
Yeah. Yeah. Is we become aware of the space through the practice of the meditation.
Sure. That's what, you know, many of you heard of dialectical behavior therapy, DBT. Very popular. With Marshall Linehan at the University of Washington pioneered it for people with borderline personality disorder who were thought to be untreatable because they're so impulsive. And she was a Zen student, and she adapted Zen to treat these people. So what they do is they learn mindfulness. And they learn when they have an impulse to watch the impulse rather than immediately acting out the impulse. And now that's the treatment, or a treatment of choice for addictions. They teach, G. Allen Marlatt, before he died, he was a primary addiction researcher in the world. He moved from using cognitive behavioral therapy to using mindfulness as his primary treatment. And he treated meth addicts, crack addicts, heroin addicts, and they learned to sit there and watch the whole wave of I got to have it and it hurts so much passed through them without acting on it. I never would have thought that those people would be able to do that, but that was his last method of treatment.
That who was that? Like,
G. Allen Marlatt, M-A-R-L-A-T-T.
G. Allen
Marlatt, M-A-R-L-A-T-T. He died recently, but I'm sure there's a ton of stuff on him. Glenn, and then we got to move.
Spence, I had that very thing happen to me last night when I was standing in front of the refrigerator at 10:30.
Folks, impulses. This is we all have addictions, or we all have strong desires, and this is the way to weaken those and free yourself from those. So, if you want the cigarette, if you want the drink, if you want the food, you just stop for a second in your tracks. Feel your breathing. Feel the desire move through you. Watch it. Look at it as if it were a movie, some fascinating thing. And it will pass through you rapidly. Desire doesn't last a long time. It comes and it peaks, and then it's like a wave, and then it goes. Then you're free of it for a while. Then the next desire comes. And, you know, when people are quitting smoking, they say, look, if it comes a third time, then have the cigarette. But the first two times, let it go. So you don't have to say to yourself, oh my God, I'm never going to smoke again, because it'll be too hard. But every time you let the desire pass through you for anything, and you don't act on it, you weaken the link between the impulse and the action. So you gain more, I guess, neuropsychologically, or in terms of neuroscience, what you're doing is you're strengthening the prefrontal cortex and the anterior cingulate cortex of these areas in the front of your mind, so that the motivational center in the middle of your mind, in the limbic system, doesn't have so much immediate power over you. You're getting smarter, you're getting more self-control, and you're being less controlled by your more animal primitive levels.
How about the idea that you always have to substitute addiction by something else?
The other idea is that you if there's a need, the addiction serves a need. So you have to find another way to get that need satisfied that's more healthy. That's also true. But immediately, you can let go of the action, the impulse leading to the action. But then you have to ask yourself, why am I overeating? Why am I smoking? Why? And what could better serve that need? Because there's something motivating you to be continually doing that. So yeah, you need to satisfy your needs. Otherwise, those needs are going to keep coming up in dysfunctional ways. Okay. So Abraham.
Yeah, satisfying the need by just taking a small portion of it. Like one puff of a cigarette, or one bite, or whatever you're looking for.
You could do that. Eventually, you want to get away from the cigarette entirely, but you could wean yourself by taking more satisfaction with less of something. So you could, in fact, eat your ice cream, but instead of eating the whole carton, you would just eat a little bit, and you would eat it mindfully. And that would satisfy that need in a more complete way. Okay. We have to move. All right, I'll just tell you because I don't want to write on the board. Results of the poll of last week. Alternative one was you prefer an hour. This is for springtime, not for winter. For winter, it's the same thing as this. Hour and a half, 10:15 to 11:45. But the question was, what about spring? So question: alternative one, prefer an hour and three quarters at $70. 32 people voted for that. Second, okay with the hour and three quarter at $70, but prefer the hour the way it is now, the hour and a half at 60, 27 for that. And not okay with the 70, really want to stay with the way it is now, 20 for that. So 32 preferred to switch to an hour and three quarters, and 47 preferred or strongly preferred to stay with the way it is now. So in the spring, it will be the way it is now, an hour and a half. And what that will mean is I have to get here earlier, and announcements happen at 10:10, not 10:20, and we stay an extra 5 minutes because I keep them out of the door, you know, away. And we manage to stretch it out a little bit. So I'll do that. Art. I did negotiate an art fair on Halloween. So our last class in 2 weeks, if you have art, bring the art in, and we have till noon on that day. So I'll try to stop about 11:40 with the lesson, and then we can look at the art that people bring in. So that's in 2 weeks. Upcoming classes. Next week, Michael Geis, Nancy Gunsberg, and I will sit in front of the room and answer questions about the process of psychotherapy and anything germane to that. And then in 2 weeks, we'll do an experience, because it's be Halloween. So bring something, come in costume if you like, but whether you come in costume or not, that's where we're going. Bring something to write on and something to write with. Okay, so paper and pen or pencil.
Is that 11:01?
Say again?
Is that November 1st?
No, it's October 31st.
Yeah, that's last day of class.
Okay. All right, so back to where we our story so far. Okay, we're talking about big data. And first thing I said last, because some of you weren't here, I'll catch you up real quickly. First thing I said is 90% of the world's data has been generated in the last 2 years. 90%. So where are they keeping all this information? In data centers. How big are the data centers? At current, the data centers occupy 666 million square feet. Which means that each of us has about 2 square feet of data, probably 20 feet high. Now, a flash drive is a little thing, you know, put a lot of that together. That's how much data there is for each person. Now, it's not all about you, but the point is 666 million square feet is a lot of data. The largest data center, there are many, about 1 million square feet. The largest one is in New York City, it's Google's. And it's 2,900,000 square feet, which is 24 Costcos put together. That's one data center. There are 3 enormous ones in New York City, actually. They're spread around the country and around the world. There's a lot of data being gathered. What about this data? And then we started to look at what about this data. Make sure I don't leave anything out. Oh, yeah. I talked about some of the uses of it. I read you an article about drone agriculture. The idea that farmers now have these little helicopters or little $1,000 drones that fly over their fields and take pictures and give them information about where the crop is doing well, where it's not doing well, so that they can more precisely tune their crop. Also, the tractors now can plant seeds within millimeters of where they're using GPS, millimeters of where they want to go. Everything is data-driven so that yield is maximized, pesticides are minimized, etc. So in agriculture, this is proving hugely important. And in other areas also. So there's a lot of upside to this. But then I talked about, oh, by the way, data. Because I'm going to use it both ways. Data is plural. Datum is singular. D-A-T-U-M. So you're supposed to say these data, not the data. Okay. The data show. Right. You can either say the data show or the data shows. Because in common speech, data can be used singularly. In the singular, although it should be used in the plural, okay? Just so you know. All right, so then I talked about the fact that devices digital devices are becoming more merged with us. We're becoming more intimate with our devices. For example, people are very married to their phones. We talked about that. Some we've talked about that before. A statistic I just saw, I think thanks to Carl for sending me the email about the MD who talked about this. People check their phones about 150 times a day on average. So that, you know, we're pretty merged with the data that we're getting and the data that we're giving. I talked about life logging, the idea that there are some people that walk around with cameras and other recording devices and log everything about their lives. Everything. Well, that's so bizarre. So you laugh at that. But you know what? All the kids are doing that. All the kids are tweeting every 2 seconds. All the kids are Instagramming every single thing that they do. That's all going up there into the cloud. You know, and other people, their friends are all watching that. That's why they're all like this, because there's a constant data feed. Then I talked about the fact that things like the Apple Watch will be on you. So the borderline between yourself and the devices will start to evaporate as wearables happen, and eventually implants happen. So that people are working on this. I mean, this is not, this is right on the horizon, is brain implants that actually broadcast. And some of these will be, medically helpful, and others of them maybe not. So that's kind of where I left it, and that's interesting and upside. But today I have to go a little bit more into some of the potential problems with this merger of person and machine. And so I want to start with a very short video by a computer scientist. And then I will read you an article which extends what she says. So yeah, we need that. Yep. The volume isn't good. I'm going to approximate it as best I can. I won't make it distorts if I make it too loud. If I make it too low, you can hear it.
But it's the biggest, and it serves to illustrate the numbers. Facebook has 1.2 billion users per month. So half the Earth's internet population is using Facebook. They're a site, along with others, that's allowed people to create an online persona with very little technical skill. And people responded by putting huge amounts of personal data online. So the result is that we have behavioral, preference, demographic data for hundreds of millions of people, which is unprecedented in history. And as a computer scientist, what this means is that I've been able to build models that can predict all sorts of hidden attributes for all of you that you don't even know when you're sharing information about. As scientists, We use that to help the way people interact online, but there's less altruistic applications. And there's a problem in that users don't really understand these techniques and how they work, and even if they did, they don't have a lot of control over it. So what I want to talk to you about today is some of these things that we're able to do, and then give us some ideas of how we might go forward to move some control back into the hands of users. So this is Target, the company. I didn't just put that logo on the support person. You may have seen this anecdote that was printed in Forbes magazine where Target sent a flyer to this 15-year-old girl with advertisements and coupons for baby bottles and diapers and cribs 2 weeks before she told her parents that she was pregnant.
Oh my God.
Yeah, that was really upset. So how did Target figure out that this high school girl was pregnant before she told her parents? It turns out that they have the purchase history for hundreds of thousands of customers, and they compute what they call a pregnancy score, which is not just whether or not a woman is pregnant, but what her due date is. And they compute that not by looking at like the obvious things, like she's buying a crib or baby clothes, but things like she bought more vitamins than she normally had, or she bought a handbag that's big enough to hold diapers. And by themselves, those purchases don't seem like they might reveal a lot, but it's a pattern of behavior that, when you take it in the context of thousands of other people, starts to actually reveal some insights. So that's the kind of thing that we do when we're predicting stuff about you on social media. We're looking for little patterns of behavior that, when you detect them among millions of people, lets us find out all kinds of things. So in my lab and with colleagues, we've developed mechanisms where we can quite accurately predict things like your political preference, your personality score, gender, sexual orientation, religion, age, intelligence, along with things like how much you trust the people you know and how strong those relationships are. We can do all of this really well. And again, it doesn't come from what you might think of as obvious information. So my favorite example is from this study that was published this year in the Proceedings of the National Academies. If you Google it, you'll find it. It's 4 pages, easy to read. And they looked at just people's Facebook likes, so just the things you like on Facebook, and use that to predict all these attributes along with some other ones. And in their paper, they listed the 5 likes that were most indicative of high intelligence. And among those was likes on the page for curly fries. Curly fries are delicious, but liking them does not necessarily mean that you're smarter than the average person. So how is it that one of the strongest indicators of your intelligence is liking this page when the content is totally irrelevant to the attribute that's being predicted? And it turns out that we have to look at a whole bunch of underlying theories to see why we're able to do this. One of them is a sociological theory called homophily, which basically says people are friends with people like them. So if you're smart, you tend to be friends with smart people. If you're young, you tend to be friends with young people. This is well established for hundreds of years. We also know a lot about how information spreads through networks. It turns out things like viral videos or Facebook likes or other information spreads in exactly the same way that diseases spread through social networks. So this is something we've studied for a long time. We have good models of it. And so you can put those things together and start seeing why things like this happen. So if I were to give you a hypothesis, it would be that a smart guy started this page, or maybe one of the first people who liked it would have scored high on that test. And they liked it, and their friends saw it. And by homophily, we know that he probably had smart friends. And so it spread to them, and some of them liked it. And they had smart friends, and so it spread to them. And so it propagated through the network to kind of a host of smart people. So that by the end, the action of liking the curly fries page is indicative of high intelligence, not because of the content, but because the actual action of liking reflects back the common attributes of other people who have done it. So this is pretty complicated stuff, right? It's a hard thing to sit down and explain to an average user. And even if you do, what can the average user do about it? How do you know that you like something that indicates a trait for you that's totally irrelevant to the content of what you like? There's a lot of power that users don't have to control how this data is used. And I see that as a real problem going forward. So I think there's a couple paths that we want to look at if we want to give users some control over how this data is used. Because it's not always going to be used for their benefit. An example I often give is that if I ever get bored being a professor, I'm going to go start a company that predicts all of these attributes and things like how well you work in teams and if you're a drug user, if you're an alcoholic. We know how to predict all that. And I'm going to sell reports to HR companies and big businesses that want to hire you. We totally can do that now. I could start that business tomorrow, and you would have absolutely no control over me using your data like that. That seems to me to be a problem. So one of the paths we can go down is the policy and law path. And in some respects, I think that that would be most effective, but the problem is we actually have to do it. Observing our political process in action makes me think it's highly unlikely that we're going to get a bunch of representatives to sit down, learn about this, and then enact sweeping changes to intellectual property law in the U.S. so users control their data. We could go the policy route, where social media companies say, you know what, you own your data, you have total control over how it's used. The problem is that the revenue models for most social media companies rely on sharing or exploiting users' data in some way. It's sometimes said at Facebook that the users aren't the customer, they're the product. And so how do you get a company to cede control of their main asset back to the users? It's possible, but I don't think it's something that we're going to see change quickly. So I think the other path that we can go down that's going to be more effective is one of more science. It's doing science that allowed us to develop all these mechanisms for computing this personal data in the first place. And it's actually very similar research that we have to do if we want to develop mechanisms that can say to a user, here's the risk of that action you just took. You know, by liking that Facebook page or by sharing this piece of personal information, you've now improved my ability to predict whether or not you're using drugs or whether or not you get along well in the workplace. And that, I think, can affect whether or not people want to share something, keep it private, or just keep it offline altogether. We can also look at things like allowing people to encrypt data that they upload, so it's kind of invisible and worthless to sites like Facebook or third-party services that access it, but that select users who the person who posted it want to see it have access to see it. This is all super exciting research from an intellectual perspective, and so scientists are going to be willing to do it. So that gives us an advantage over the law side. One of the problems that people bring up when I talk about this is they say, you know, if people start keeping all this data private, all those methods that you've been developing to predict their traits are going to fail. And I say, absolutely. And for me, that's success. Because as a scientist, my goal is not to infer information about users. It's to improve the way people interact online. And sometimes that involves inferring things about them. But if users don't want me to use that data, I think they should have the right to do that. I want users to be informed and consenting users of the tools that we develop. And so I think encouraging this kind of science and supporting researchers who want to cede some of that control back to users and away from the social media companies means that going forward, as these tools evolve and advance, means that we're going to have an educated and empowered user base. And I think all of us can agree that that's a pretty ideal way to go forward. Thank you.
Jennifer Goldbeck, G-O-L-B-E-C-K. Okay.
Can you leave it there for a minute? Let's see.
They can be sort of halfway because we're going to watch something else in about 15 minutes, I think. Okay, so this is on the level of individual people and how much can be inferred about you from things like your likes on Facebook. Now, multiply this or realize that when data starts streaming from your Apple Watch out into the cloud, there's a whole lot more and a whole lot more personal kinds of information that are going to be getting out there. But this is on the level of individuals. The question is, what about on the level of society? And this is an article that I'm going to read part of to you from Technology Review, May-June of this month, of this year. It's called The Limits of Social Engineering. In 1969, Tell me, by the way, tell me if you can't hear, and if I lose voice, I will use the microphone. But can you hear me now well enough? Yeah, good, okay. In 1969, Playboy published a long, freewheeling interview with Marshall McLuhan, in which the media theorist and 60s icon sketched a portrait of the future that was at once seductive and repellent. Noting the ability of digital computers to analyze data and communicate messages, he predicted that the machines eventually would be deployed to fine-tune society's workings. Quote, "The computer can be used to direct a network of global thermostats to pattern life in ways that will optimize human awareness," end quote, he said. Quote, "Already it's technologically feasible to employ the computer to program societies in beneficial ways," end quote. He acknowledged that such centralized control raised the specter of, quote, brainwashing or far worse, end quote, but he stressed that, quote, "the programming of societies could actually be conducted quite constructively and humanistically," end quote. The interview appeared when computers were used mainly for arcane scientific and industrial number crunching. To most readers at the time, McLuhan's words must have sounded far-fetched, if not downright nutty. Now they sound prophetic. With smartphones ubiquitous, Facebook inescapable, and wearable computers like Google Glass emerging, society is gaining a digital sensing system. People's location and behavior are being tracked as they go through their days, and the resulting information is being transmitted instantaneously to vast server farms. Once we write the algorithms needed to parse all that big data, many sociologists and statisticians believe we'll be rewarded with a much deeper understanding of what makes society tick. One of big data's keenest advocates is Alex Sandy Pentland, a data scientist who, as the director of MIT's Human Dynamics Laboratory, has long used computers to study the behavior of businesses and other organizations. In his brief but ambitious new book, Social Physics, Pentland argues that our greatly expanded ability to gather behavioral data will allow scientists to develop, quote, "a causal theory of social structure," end quote, and ultimately establish, quote, "a mathematical explanation for why society reacts as it does," end quote. As the book's title makes clear, Pentland thinks that the social world, no less than the material world, operates according to rules. There are, quote, "statistical regularities within human movement and communication," end quote. And once we fully discover those regularities, we will discover, quote, "the basic mechanisms of social interactions," end quote. What's prevented us from deciphering society's mathematical underpinnings up till now, Pentland believes, is a lack of empirical rigor in the social sciences. Unlike physicists who can measure the movement of objects with great precision, sociologists have to make do with fuzzy observations. They've had to work with rough and incomplete data sets drawn from small samples of the population. And they've had to rely on people's notoriously flawed recollections of what they did, when they did it, and whom they did it with. Computer networks promise to remedy these shortcomings. Tapping into the streams of data that flow through gadgets, search engines, social media, and credit card payment systems, scientists will be able to collect precise, real-time information on the behavior of millions, if not billions, of individuals. And because computers never forget nor fib, the information will be reliable. To illustrate what lies in store, Pentland describes a series of experiments that he and his associates have been conducting in the private sector. They go into businesses and give each employee an electronic ID card, called a sociometric badge, that hangs from the neck and communicates with the badges worn by colleagues. Incorporating microphones, location sensors, and accelerometers, the badges monitor where people go and whom they talk with, taking note of their tone of voice and even their body language. The devices are able to measure not only the chains of communication and influence within organizations, but also the personal energy levels and traits just as such as extroversion and empathy. In one such study of a bank's call center, the researchers discovered that productivity could be increased simply by tweaking the coffee break schedule. So people are being monitored, and all kinds of information about them individually and collectively is being gathered. Pentland dubs this data processing technique reality mining. And he suggests that similar kinds of information can be collected on a much broader scale by smartphones outfitted with specialized sensors and apps. And that's already happening. Fed into statistical modeling programs, the data could reveal, quote, how things such as ideas, decisions, mood, or the seasonal flu are spread in the community, end quote. The mathematical modeling of society is made possible, according to Pentland, by the innate tractability of human beings, We may think of ourselves as rational actors in conscious control of our choices, but most of what we do is reflexive. Our behavior is determined by our subliminal reactions to the influences of other people, particularly those in the various peer groups we belong to. The power of social physics, he writes, comes from the fact that almost all of our day-to-day actions are habitual, based mostly on what we've learned from observing the behavior of others, end quote. Once you map and measure all of a person's social influences, you can develop a statistical model that predicts that person's behavior, just as you can model a path a billiard ball will take after it strikes other billiard balls. Deciphering people's behavior is only the first step. What really excites Pentland is the prospect of using digital media and related tools to change people's behavior, to motivate groups and individuals to act in more productive and responsible ways. If people react predictably to social influences, then governments and businesses can use computers to develop and deliver carefully tailored incentives, such as messages of praise or small cash payments, to tune the flow of influence in a group and thereby modify the habits of its members. Beyond improving the efficiency of transit and healthcare systems, Pentland suggests, group-based incentive programs can make communities more harmonious and creative. Our main insight, he reports, is that by targeting an individual's peers, peer pressure can amplify the desired effect of a reward on the target individual. Computers can become, as McLuhan envisioned, civic thermostats. They can not only register society's state, but bring it into line with some prescribed ideal. Both the tracking and the maintenance of the social order are automated. Ultimately, Pentland argues, looking at people's interactions through a mathematical lens will free us of time-worn notions about class and class struggle. Political and economic classes, he contends, are, quote, oversimplified stereotypes of a fluid and overlapping matrix of peer groups, end quote. Peer groups, unlike classes, are defined by shared norms rather than just standard features such as income or their relationship to the means of production. So shared norms of the peer group are more important than income or relationship to means of production. Armed with exhaustive information about individuals' habits and associations, civic planners will be able to trace the full flow of influences that shape personal behavior. Abandoning general categories like rich and poor or haves and have-nots, we'll be able to understand people as individuals, even if those individuals are no more than the sums of all the peer pressures and social influences that affect them. So what he's saying is we'll be able to, using this data, we'll be able to to change your behavior so that it's more pro-social as individuals, and we'll be able to change the entire behavior of society so that it's more pro-social. That may raise a little bit of a concern in you. Let me read a little bit more of what this reviewer says, and then I'll take questions. Okay, Carl, you want to say right now?
What do you mean by pro-social?
Oh, that's what we're getting to. Okay, so okay. Let me do a couple more paragraphs, and then we'll talk about this a little bit. The implications. Get,
I have three words: naively optimistic.
Okay, so this is written by Nicholas Carr. He writes on technology and culture, and his new book, The Glass Cage, Automation and Us, will be published in September. So here's what he says. Replacing politics with programming may sound appealing, particularly given Washington's current paralysis. But there are good reasons to be nervous about this sort of social engineering. Most obvious are the privacy concerns raised by collecting ever more intimate personal information. Pentland anticipates such criticisms by arguing for a new deal on data that gives people direct control over the information collected about them. It's hard, though, to imagine internet companies agreeing to give up ownership of the behavioral information that's crucial to their competitive advantage. Even if we assume that the privacy issues can be resolved, the idea of what Pentland calls a data-driven society remains somewhat problematic. Social physics is a variation on the theory of behaviorism that found favor in Marshall McLuhan's day, and it suffers from the same limitations that doomed its predecessor. Defining social relations as a pattern of stimulus and response makes the math easier, but it ignores the deep structural sources of social ills. Pentland may be right that our behavior is determined largely by social norms and the influences of our peers, but what he fails to see is that those norms and influences are themselves shaped by history, politics, and economics, not to mention power and prejudice. People don't have complete freedom in choosing their peer groups. Their peer groups are constrained by where they live, where they come from, how much money they have, and what they look like. A statistical model of society that ignores issues of class, that takes patterns of influence as givens rather than historical contingencies, will tend to perpetuate existing social structures and dynamics. It will encourage us to optimize the status quo rather than challenge it. Your influence to be more like your peer group, then your peer group is determined by all sorts of social strata and historical things, and we'll just make the alphas more alpha and the betas more beta in remember Brave New World, and the gammas more gamma. We'll just make the peer groups, we'll make the strata more stratified. There's another problem here, which is he says that stimulus behaviorism, which says that people are just reactions to their environment, rewards and punishments from the environment totally shape who you are. That's what B.F. Skinner said, right? He wrote a book called Beyond Freedom and Dignity, in which he said that the idea that you have free will has been conditioned into you. You have no free will. Even the thought that you have free will is a result of your conditioning. That is what the rewards and punishments have been. There's no such thing as freedom and dignity. What we need to do is we need to make society reward and punish that which we want society to be like, because people are just billiard balls. What he's saying is people aren't just billiard balls. No matter how you reward them or punish them, there's huge histories and huge issues of social structure that will override those individual rewards and punishments. So even if we find a way to make everybody in the Middle East happy, still those old enmities will lead to division. Okay. I wish I could believe all that he just said, but I don't believe it. Okay, I believe that if I rule the world, Okay. By the way, don't let me. If I ruled the world and I could influence all the media, and I could put away everybody over the age of 10 forever, I could raise a generation of children around the world who, even if I didn't put away the old folks, okay, I could use social media and the media in general to teach children everywhere in the world that what they wanted was a 3,000 square foot house and an SUV, and here's how to get it, and that the old their parents saying, we hate that group, and you're this, not that, and can't you see that they're a different color than you are, a different religion than you are, that would be less important than what their peers were doing and what the media was telling them to do. And I do believe that all those old enmities and all those old social structural things that have come so far in society could be left behind in a generation. For better or for worse, depending on what the kids saw. Excuse me, Michael, you got to make sure this doesn't... It's okay. It's still okay. As evidence for that, I'd like to suggest how you grew up and what you learned about other people other than your religion or your ethnic group, and how as we walk around, we still have those words and thoughts go through our mind, and we go, are we ever going to get over that? And a better part of ourselves has to constantly correct us. The kids are colorblind. They don't see it, and they're all tuned into the latest pop star. And they talk to each other across the world by Instagram. And, you know, the vision they see is old people versus them. They don't see any of these. Those divisions are fading away rapidly. And I think that those divisions would fade away entirely. So I think that the argument that if you manipulated by social media, you could, in fact, manipulate the world. There would be no reason that you couldn't tune society in the way you wish to tune society. The question is, who's going to decide what way that is? Okay. So let's see. Let's have a couple of questions about this, and then I've got we have 3 minutes, and then I have to show you something else. Okay. So the first hand I saw was Peter's. Second hand I saw was Abraham. Third hand I saw was Morty's. And fourth hand I saw was Carl's. Quickly.
Yes. I'm a clinical anthropologist, so this is all very interesting. That idea of eliminating all the old world divisions is great, and that's what would happen. So they're not talking about that. What they're talking about is products. All they want to do is sell everybody ultimately the same product, so the creature would be the same creature, essentially.
That's
really what it's all about.
At this point, now, Pentland's saying if good people got a hold of this, they could make society go in the right direction. But right now, who's got a hold of this? People that want to sell you something.
Right.
Okay. Who's next? Abraham was next, and then Morty, and then Carl. Okay.
The only thing that they cannot control is our ability to choose. Because, you know, we grow, we change. Maybe I like ice cream 5 years ago, but now I like candy or something.
Okay.
You know, what I'm saying is, maybe it's a waste of time to collect all these data and just put it in a big space, hoping that, you could change the world with it.
Okay, so the question really, what Abraham is getting at is, maybe there's some part of us that is beyond conditioning, that makes authentic choices in the moment, that actually has free will. And that's a huge debate. I tend not to think so. I hope I'm wrong. Okay, Morty, quickly, and then Carl, then I got to show you something.
James Bryson of the New York Times is weighing whether they're going to prison or not, for not divulging the fact that who his source was for all of this coming out to begin with, and the Times refused to run it. It's still up in the air, and all of this is not, in my mind, for apparel and food and this. It's for
okay. So we're going there right now. We're going to that to Morty's comment right now, Carl.
Well, I think it was this neglect of the
if you ruled the internet and censored everything, then you would restrict information, but it would go underground like it did in the Soviet Union, and it became overwhelmingly powerful. If you didn't restrict the internet like it is now, there's plenty of dissenting opinion, and children become naturally rebellious, and they reject things wholesale and look critically at what their elders are doing. So, I don't think that you can govern. You can't eliminate the power of rebellion unless you start drugging everybody too.
Yeah. So that's an interesting comment. The idea that even if we seduce every kid, somebody would say this is seduction. Somebody would be bright enough to say you're seducing us all.
Well, that happened in the Soviet Union, and it disintegrated.
Okay, so that's an interesting comment that somebody would see through the matrix, no matter how nicely we made the matrix. Okay. So I want to show you this. It's the last thing I'll show you today. By the way, okay, we're going to end up on October 31st on a very positive note. We're kind of on a low note now. We're going to a high note. Got to show you this. I did not want to show you this. Okay, I really did not want to show you this video, but I thought I have to. Even if you don't agree with what he says, you probably will. But listen to how he uses words. This is a journalist who was born to be a journalist. This is Glenn Greenwald, who's the journalist who I think did more than anybody else to get Snowden's information out. He's going to talk. Well, you should see him. He talks about it. Here goes. And again, I wish I didn't have to show you this. Thank you.
There is an entire genre of YouTube videos devoted to an experience which I'm certain that everyone in this room has had. It entails an individual who, thinking they're alone, engages in some expressive behavior while singing, gyrating, dancing, some mild sexual activity, only to discover that, in fact, they are not alone, that there's a person watching and lurking, the discovery of which causes them to immediately cease what they're doing in horror. The sense of shame and humiliation in their face is palpable. It's the sense of, this is something I'm willing to do only if no one else is watching. This is the crux of the work on which I have been singularly focused for the last 16 months, the question of why privacy matters, a question that has arisen in the context of a global debate enabled by the revelations of Edward Snowden that the United States and its partners, unbeknownst to the entire world, has converted the internet, once heralded as an unprecedented tool of liberation and democratization, into an unprecedented zone of mass indiscriminate surveillance. There is a very common sentiment that arises in this debate, even among people who are uncomfortable with mass surveillance, which says that there's no real harm that comes from this large-scale invasion because only people who are engaged in bad acts have a reason to want to hide and to care about their privacy. This worldview is implicitly grounded in the proposition that there are two kinds of people in the world, good people and bad people. Bad people are those who plot terrorist attacks or who engage in violent criminality and therefore have reasons to want to hide what they're doing, have reasons to care about their privacy. But by contrast, good people are people who go to work, come home, raise their children, watch television. They use the internet not to plot bombing attacks, but to read the news or exchange recipes or to plan their kids' Little League games. And those people are doing nothing wrong and therefore have nothing to hide and no reason to fear the government monitoring them. The people who are actually saying that are engaged in a very extreme act of self-deprecation. What they're really saying is, I have agreed to make myself such a harmless and unthreatening and uninteresting person that I actually don't fear having the government know what it is that I'm doing. This mindset has found what I think is its purest expression in a 2009 interview with the longtime CEO of Google, Eric Schmidt, who, when asked about all the different ways his company is causing invasions of privacy for hundreds of millions of people around the world, said this. He said, "If you're doing something that you don't want other people to know, maybe you shouldn't be doing it in the first place." Now, there's all kinds of things to say about that mentality. The first of which is that the people who say that privacy isn't really important, they don't actually believe it. And the way you know that they don't actually believe it is that while they say with their words that privacy doesn't matter, with their actions they take all kinds of steps to safeguard their privacy. They put passwords on their email and their social media accounts. They put locks on their bedroom and bathroom doors. All steps designed to prevent other people from entering what they consider their private realm and knowing what it is that they don't want other people to know. The very same Eric Schmidt, the CEO of Google, ordered his employees at Google to cease speaking with the online internet magazine CNET, after CNET published an article full of personal private information about Eric Schmidt, which it obtained exclusively through Google searches and using other Google products. This same division can be seen with the CEO of Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, who in an infamous interview in 2010 pronounced that privacy is no longer a, quote, social norm. Last year, Mark Zuckerberg and his new wife purchased not only their own house, but also all four adjacent houses in Palo Alto for a total of $30 million in order to ensure that they enjoy a zone of privacy that prevented other people from monitoring what they do in their personal lives. Over the last 16 months, as I've debated this issue around the world, every single time somebody has said to me, "I don't really worry about invasions of privacy because I don't have anything to hide," I always say the same thing to them. I get out a pen, I write down my email address, I say, "Here's my email address. What I want you to do when you get home is email me the passwords to all of your email accounts. Not just the nice, respectable work one in your name, but all of them. Because I want to be able to just troll through what it is you're doing online, read what I want to read, and publish whatever I find interesting. After all, if you're not a bad person, if you're doing nothing wrong, you should have nothing to hide." Not a single person has taken me up on that offer. I check that email account religiously all the time. It's a very desolate place. And there's a reason for that, which is that we as human beings, even those of us who in words disclaim the importance of our own privacy, instinctively understand the profound importance of it. It is true that as human beings we're social animals, which means we have a need for other people to know what we're doing and saying and thinking, which is why we voluntarily publish information about ourselves online. But equally essential to what it means to be a free and fulfilled human being is to have a place that we can go and be free of the judgmental eyes of other people. There's a reason why we seek that out, and our reason is that all of us, not just terrorists and criminals, all of us have things to hide. There are all sorts of things that we do and think that we're willing to tell our physician or our lawyer or our psychologist or our spouse or our best friend that we would be mortified for the rest of the world to learn. We make judgments every single day about the kinds of things that we say and think and do that we're willing to have other people know and the kinds of things that we say and think and do that we don't want anyone else to know about. People can very easily in words claim that they don't value their privacy, but their actions negate the authenticity of that belief. Now, there's a reason why privacy is so craved universally and instinctively. It isn't just a reflexive movement like breathing air or drinking water. The reason is that when we're in a state where we can be monitored, where we can be watched, our behavior changes dramatically. The range of behavioral options that we consider when we think we're being watched severely reduces. This is just a fact of human nature that has been recognized in social science and in literature and in religion and in virtually every field of discipline. There are dozens of psychological studies that prove that when somebody knows that they might be watched, the behavior they engage in is vastly more conformist and compliant. Human shame is a very powerful motivator, as is the desire to avoid it. And that's the reason why people, when they're in a state of being watched, make decisions not that are the byproduct of their own agency, but that are about the expectations that others have of them or the mandates of societal orthodoxy. This realization was exploited most powerfully for pragmatic ends by the 18th century philosopher Jeremy Bentham, who set out to resolve an important problem ushered in by the Industrial Age, where, for the first time, institutions had become so large and centralized that they were no longer able to monitor and therefore control each one of their individual members. And the solution that he devised was an architectural design originally intended to be implemented in prisons that he called the Panopticon, the primary attribute of which was the construction of an enormous tower in the center of the institution, where whoever controlled the institution could at any moment watch any of the inmates, although they couldn't watch all of them at all times. And crucial to this design was that the inmates could not actually see into the panopticon, into the tower, and so they never knew if they were being watched or even when. And what made him so excited about this discovery was that that would mean that the prisoners would have to assume that they were being watched at any given moment, which would be the ultimate enforcer for obedience and compliance. The 20th century French philosopher Michel Foucault realized that that model could be used not just for prisons, but for every institution that seeks to control human behavior: schools, hospitals, factories, workplaces. And what he said was that this mindset, this framework discovered by Bentham, was the key means of societal control for modern Western societies, which no longer need the overt weapons of tyranny, punishing or imprisoning or killing dissidents, or legally compelling loyalty to a particular party, because mass surveillance creates a prison in the mind that is a much more subtle but much more effective means of fostering compliance with social norms or with social orthodoxy, much more effective than brute force could ever be. The most iconic work of literature about surveillance and privacy is the George Orwell novel 1984, which we all learned in school, and therefore it's almost become a cliché. In fact, whenever you bring it up in a debate about surveillance, people instantaneously dismiss it as inapplicable. And what they say is, oh, well, in 1984, there were monitors in people's homes, they were being watched at every given moment, and that has nothing to do with the surveillance state that we face. That is the actual fundamental misapprehension of the warnings that Orwell issued in 1984. The warning that he was issuing was about a surveillance state, not that monitored everybody at all times, but where people were aware that they could be monitored at any given moment. Here is how Orwell's narrator, Winston Smith, described the surveillance system that they faced. Quote, "There was, of course, no way of knowing whether you were being watched at any given moment." He went on to say, "At any rate, they could plug in your wire whenever they wanted to. You had to live, did live, from habit that became instinct, in the assumption that every sound you made was overheard, and except in darkness, every movement scrutinized." The Abrahamic religion similarly posits that there is an invisible, all-knowing authority who, because of its omniscience, always watches whatever you're doing, which means you never have a private moment, the ultimate enforcer for obedience to its dictates. What all of these seemingly disparate works recognize, the conclusion that they all reach, is that a society in which people can be monitored at all times is a society that breeds conformity and obedience and submission, which is why every tyrant, the most overt to the most subtle, craves that system. Conversely, even more importantly, it is a realm of privacy, the ability to go somewhere where we can think and reason and interact and speak without the judgmental eyes of others being cast upon us, in which creativity and exploration and dissent exclusively reside. And that is the reason why, when we allow a society to exist in which we're subject to constant monitoring, we allow the essence of human freedom to be severely crippled. The last point I want to observe about this mindset, the idea that only people who are doing nothing wrong have things to hide and therefore reasons to care about privacy, is that it entrenches two very destructive messages, two destructive lessons. The first of which is that the only people who care about privacy, the only people who will seek out privacy, are by definition bad people. This is a conclusion that we should have all kinds of reasons for avoiding. The most important of which is that when you say somebody who's doing bad things, you probably mean things like plotting a terrorist attack or engaging in violent criminality, a much narrower conception of what people who wield power mean when they say doing bad things. For them, doing bad things typically means doing something that poses meaningful challenges to the exercise of our own power. The other really destructive and I think even more insidious lesson that comes from accepting this mindset is there's an implicit bargain that people who accept this mindset have accepted. And that bargain is this. If you're willing to render yourself sufficiently harmless, sufficiently unthreatening to those who wield political power, then and only then can you be free of the dangers of surveillance. It's only those who are dissidents, who challenge power, who have something to worry about. There are all kinds of reasons why we should want to avoid that lesson as well. You may be a person who right now doesn't want to engage in that behavior, but at some point in the future you might. Even if you're somebody who decides you never want to, the fact that there are other people who are willing to and able to resist and be adversarial to those in power, dissidents and journalists and activists and a whole range of others, is something that brings us all collective good that we should want to preserve. Equally critical is that the measure of how free a society is not how it treats its good, obedient, compliant citizens, but how it treats its dissidents and those who resist orthodoxy. But the most important reason is that a system of mass surveillance suppresses our own freedom in all sorts of ways. It renders off limits all kinds of behavioral choices without our even knowing that it's happened. The renowned socialist activist Rosa Luxemburg once said, "He who does not move does not notice his chains." We can try and render the chains of mass surveillance invisible or undetectable, but the constraints that it imposes on us do not become any less potent. Thank you very much.
Those of you who, I need the, a little light. Those of you who want to see the last 4 minutes, the host asked him about Snowden. I don't want to go there now. But if you want to hear what he has to say about Snowden, go back to Glenn Greenwald. Okay, what I want to say in the last 2 minutes, and maybe a comment, is you realize that it is possible, in fact, it is probable that, or it is possible anyway, that it was noted somewhere that that IP address, that that computer listened to that talk. Because who would be listening to talks about, you know, not wanting to be surveyed? So they, you know, it could be that information would be easily collectible without our knowledge. So they could come to the owner of that computer and say, and they could look at what you took out of the library, and they could say, "We want to talk to you a little bit here." You know. Now, you know, is this paranoid? Is this crazy? I mean, we're not in a dictatorship. People are not, you know, like looking at everything we do. What Edward Snowden said is, all those companies that you try. Never mind. Michael, and then we're going to break. Okay.
I just wanted to express appreciation and gratitude for you as our leader. For allowing yourself, every class, to be audio recorded for the benefit of people here and who aren't here but can go over it again, and opening yourself to criticism or whatever, knowing that everything you're saying is always I'm grateful for that.
but of course it narrows my range of behavioral options. Believe me, it does. Okay, so the question is why we have been for two sessions dealing with some of this difficult stuff. It's because the charge of the class is dual. It's to become more conscious of ourselves and how we can be healthier as people. And also, the charge of the class is to become more conscious of the ways of what's happening in the world that affects us as individuals and affects the whole societal structure. And this is something that you can ignore, but it's a compelling and a hugely growing concern. Because each of us is generating these data, which we have reason to be worried about what is being done with what we are generating. Okay, so it's something we have to look at. In next week and in 2 weeks, we're going to look much more at a much more hopeful aspect of ourselves, or a much more positive aspect of ourselves. Carl, and then we'll break.
Why were you hesitant to show this stuff?
Because it's so... It's depressing. Yeah, except this was a little darker. Last week we talked about a lot of information. This was the fact that this information can really hurt you individually and can hurt the whole society.
But
okay, so we have to.
He makes us aware to fight for our freedom. So.
Yeah, it's right. The positive part of it is. Start looking at what's happening and start objecting when what's happening isn't what you want to be happening.
Raising our awareness.
Yeah, raising your awareness of something you need to be aware of. Okay, I'll see you next week. Okay.